With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome back to Killer Fun, where we explore the intersection of crime and entertainment every other week. I'm Christy.
And I'm Jackie.
Today, we have a listener request. Carlos asked that we talk about Eileen Wuornos. Now, he didn't have a specific form of entertainment that he wanted us to cover. He just wanted us to talk about it, which is great. And we had talked about watching Monster, which is a great movie.
Yeah, but
Charlize Theron. But it's super hard to watch, and I've seen it before. You haven't seen it. I have seen it before. And it's just, it's so good, but it's a... for me, a one-time watch.
Yeah, I get that. And I didn't watch it this time. Yeah, I went ahead and dug into the documentaries that we chose to look at and instead. So I don't know that I will, but I kind of want to.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
It's a good watch once. It's not, I can't imagine it would be one of those movies that anybody would be like, I have to own this. And they watch it, you know, on a monthly basis, like...
yeah.
Some people are with Star Wars movies or The Princess Bride or whatever.
Die Hard.
Yeah, Die Hard. There you go.
Well, I look at the movie as something like Black Hawk Down, those kind of movies. They need to be out there. They need to be made. They're great. And one day I actually will sit down to watch this movie because I feel like it's important for some reason after digging into Eileen's life and then seeing how different directors have treated her and how different authors have treated her. I definitely want to see Monster.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm also a little angry at all the money made off of Eileen.
That is absolutely fair.
Yeah.
Really, I mean, she didn't, not that she should profit off of her crimes.
No.
But we'll get into why
this
is exploitative.
Yeah, why this is particularly so.
Yes.
As opposed to something like Ted Bundy's or BTK's, this situation is actually sort of different.
It really is. So we talked about what we didn't watch. What did we watch? We watched an episode of a crime documentary series that's now available on YouTube. It's called Crimes That Shook the World, and the episode about Eileen Wuornos. Now, like, if you're just going to go look for it, just look for Eileen Wuornos and The Angel of Death.
Right, and not to be confused, because there are a lot of killers out there called Angel of Death, and that's actually kind of a term people use for a certain type of killer. So definitely search the crimes that shook the world, and then Eileen.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll talk about who was in it. I think most of the actors in this were amateurs.
Oh, likely, because it was like a Discovery Channel sort of thing. So it was a reenactment.
Right. Exactly. Well, almost everybody who's in this is their only or one of their only IMDb credits. So Fawn Wallace played Eileen. Cindy Simmons played Tyria. She had one other credit in IMDb. Michael Ray Davies played Richard Mallory. Tom Smith plays Charles Humphrey. Jim Martin, who stood in for Mike Joyner, and all the rest of the people other than that appeared as themselves.
Right,
so
they were all interviewed.
We have a bunch of people who are not professional actors, at least in the fact that they're listed in Internet Movie Database. Maybe they're stage actors who had this one gig, or they're just...
people who they pulled off of the production team, because Discovery Channel obviously didn't spend a whole lot of money on this.
No.
And they got thrust into the spotlight, and you know what? Editing is good.
Yes. And you know what? I didn't find the acting to be poor.
Actually, I didn't. It was probably one of the better reenactments.
Yes.
Because there's some stellar, awesome ones out there that are only stellar because they're fun to make fun of.
Oh, yes. Yes, yes, yes. So the only really big name in this was the narrator, Tim Peugeot Smith. he's had tons and tons of small parts and narrating gigs going back like all the way to 1970 and right up until his death in 2017. He worked pretty consistently, and being a narrator was a big thing for him. He had a great voice for it. So it was a little maybe over dramatic.
It was a little classic.
It's classic.
It was a little classic.
If you do recognize him, it's probably because he played the Calvinist minister in Gangs of New York. And he was a character named Creedy in V for Vendetta. Oh. So he's had a couple of like high profile small parts.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So let's recap this documentary.
Yes.
Okay. I felt like it was really old.
I know, it did.
I felt like it was like 90s old.
But it's so not.
2009.
It's just so classic in its style. It's very classic Discovery Channel, History Channel,
yeah,
sort of thing.
And it's still very made for the old TVs.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It was right at the cusp of... Everybody hasn't gone 4K yet. Most people still have a tube TV, or, you know, whatever that ratio is.
4:3.
There we go. Thank you. I knew you would know.
Yeah.
It was still that. So it had a real 90s vibe to me, but it was like 2008 because Monster had been out for years before this came out.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was interesting. So worth a note up top if you decide you want to go and watch this. I will link to it on our social media. So you can find that on Twitter at Killer Fun Pod. You can find us on Facebook, Killer Fun Podcast, exploring the intersection of crime and entertainment. Or you can send me an email, killerfunpodcast@gmail.com, and I'll shoot you back a link. All right. So the police find an abandoned vehicle. But this isn't really all that unusual because people go missing because it's Florida.
Well,
this
it's Florida.
This is kind of the argument that they have. It's Florida.
Literally, they use that argument and, you know, it wasn't a thing then. It wasn't, quote, a hashtag then. Yeah,
Florida man was not yet a phenomenon.
No, it wasn't, but it was.
It was
born out of truth, man. You know, I love it. Their whole idea was
it's really very transient. Most people who, quote unquote, go missing aren't really missing. They've just passed through, which I'm like,
the abandoned car thing. I mean, I personally know somebody who left a car abandoned on the side of the road in Florida.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Wow. I will stop there.
Okay.
I mean, I think the statutes of limitations off of this is probably past, but
we don't need to out anybody on the podcast when it comes to that. But yeah, but 5 miles away, they do find a body. So
that elevates its issue.
Yeah, exactly. It's difficult to identify. Again, their excuses, it's Florida.
It's Florida.
They're like, it's hot, it's humid, there's a lot of bug and animal activity. Makes it difficult for them to identify people if they've been out in the elements for any length of time. The victim is a divorced electrician. I noticed they're very, very concerned with the victim's marital status in this.
They were extremely concerned with the victims, and I thought they did a bang-up job making sure we understood that they were people, human, good people, despite anything else.
I'll agree with them. They didn't deserve to die.
No, they did not deserve to die. They kind of went overboard in trying to make us feel like the victims were these upstanding, amazing people, and that it was straight up targeted cold blood. And so you don't have to choose. They don't need to die, but they don't need to be elevated to saint status to prove that they shouldn't die either.
Right.
They can be dirt bags and also still not deserve to die. There you go.
Yeah. Well, I think we'll come back around to that.
Oh, we're going to come back around to that for sure.
So this guy, this first victim, was Richard Mallory, and he was shot 4 times with a .22 caliber pistol. With very little evidence, the trail goes cold. Then... in 3 months, there are 3 more murders happens very, very quickly, and all with a same type of gun.
Yeah, so now there's a pattern.
Right. So we have David Spears, who is divorced, mm-hmm. because I have to mention that only because the documentary did, and they were very concerned about it. Charles Carskadden, who was engaged, and Troy Burris, who was married.
A family man.
And a family man.
A family man.
Yes, because people who don't have families are more deserving of death.
I guess. I don't know.
So, but this fit a pattern. All of these murders. They used the same type of weapon. They were in or near a vehicle. They were all white. They were all male. They were all about the same age. And the seats in the cars were all moved as far forward as possible.
Yes, and I thought it was very interesting because they mentioned several patterns before the obvious one.
Right.
The several patterns being the 22, being that they were white men, being that they were near like a car situation. And it takes a long time into this documentary before they say, oh, and by the way, they were hooking people.
Yeah.
Like they were picking up hookers.
Yeah.
Maybe that should have been the first pattern on your mind.
Right.
Maybe that was the first thing you thought of, was that a bunch of well-to-do white men were killed in cars with seats pulled up on the side of the road.
Yeah. I don't know that they were all that well-to-do. Her clientele was typically less...
I would not have gotten that from the way they talked about these men.
No. That's fair. That's fair, because I think I only came up with that after my research. So victim number five, Charles Humphreys, is another fit. And Ward Schwab, who is a crime scene investigator, kind of makes up a profile looking at the evidence of these five murders. He says it could be a sex worker, that they were all secluded locations. It was done with a concealable gun, partial nudity of the victims.
Yeah.
Hello. Discarded condoms. Hello.
Another thing that they all said was a pattern before they said picking up hookers.
Yeah.
Just throwing that out there.
Yep.
I know I sound uber biased, and I kind of am, but I have to tell you, I did come into this not expecting to have this reaction. I did not expect that I would watch this documentary and feel like it was misogynistic or anything. I didn't think that. I was actually surprised, and I was halfway through the documentary before I went, I don't understand why they're telling this story this way. And I'm literally thinking, I wonder what the point of that is. What's going to be the twist? And then when they finally sort of talked about her being a hooker and all this stuff, all of a sudden I was like, oh my gosh. Yeah. It's because they couldn't find themselves to sully the reputation of these victims by saying that they had picked up a sex worker. Like, it hit me kind of like a ton of bricks. So I just want to put that out there because it sounds like I'm just on a feminist rampage right now. And it's not true. I really did come into this and be surprised.
Okay.
Because I had watched another short little documentary that didn't do that at all.
Okay.
So I was actually just confused by the take.
Yeah. It's interesting. And that's what's hard, because I don't have time to watch 4 1-hour documentaries to pick which one we're going to talk about.
No. And I watched two basically 40-minute documentaries. Right. And the first one was just a little different. I mean, it wasn't at all sympathetic to Eileen Wuornos, but it wasn't exactly, glowing the other way.
This one
There's some skew.
But we'll circle back around to that.
Prime time.
Oh, yeah. But the idea that this is a female serial killer is shocking.
Yeah, shocking.
Shocking.
Which, yeah. Again. Yeah. I mean, I get that, but...
Yeah.
What I thought was interesting was that they noted first the pattern, the 22 being kind of a woman's gun.
Right.
And which, that was the first thing, and I think that was probably very shocking for them, because they hadn't seen serial murders with a 22.
Right.
That was odd.
Right. Police seem to have a hard time finding evidence in the vehicles. The killer cleans up. And so they start looking at cold cases to find similar MOs to try and maybe find some leads. They find a crashed car of a man who fits the victim profile, Peter Sims. And they do find a fragile, bloody palm print in the vehicle. I was really confused, though, because they said you couldn't see this palm print unless you removed the armrest.
Yeah, I don't
know.
And
I was super confused as to how that was even possible.
I think it was because it was sort of underneath.
Oh,
and maybe okay. Because they removed it, they were able to see that the palm print. When you go to open a door and you open the latch and you push.
Oh, okay.
Right? So you kind of push underneath. Okay, so maybe it would have been very hard to see if you hadn't flipped the door around or flipped the armrest around and saw that there was something going on there. Oh,
okay. That makes more sense. Okay,
felt
good.
Like they were.
Oh, good. Because I wanted to ask about them. I'm like, what? I was very confused. Yeah, but that makes sense. If the car has been crashed, she might have needed to pull the latch and also push on the door if it was jammed at
right.
all. That makes a lot more sense. But there's no body. But there was a witness who saw two people with blood on them kind of near the vehicle, and they were both women. Then they find another body. November of 1990, the frequency of the murders seems to be increasing, and this is troubling. The body is identified as Walter Antonio, a truck driver, and they don't mention his marital status, but they do say that he's a reserve police officer.
Right, right.
Just worth a note. They could tell by indents on his fingers and wrist that he'd had jewelry removed, rings, and a watch at least. And the police are just, they're desperate at this point. This is big news. It's happening. The media knows about it. They don't have any leads to give them. They're just desperate. So they release the sketches from the witness who saw the two women with the Peter Sims vehicle.
I like to see how the police recounted how they came up with that decision, how they deliberated on it. I felt like the police did it.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Wonderful job. I mean, they were connecting dots the best they could. They were very overt about not closing doors and trying to find a rabbit hole and force something. I thought the police did a wonderful job in the search for this killer.
I absolutely
and
agree.
And then deciding to release it, they released it knowing all of these adverse consequences that could happen and had to make a decision. That was a tough decision.
Right. Yes. Yeah. I don't think that she was necessarily treated fairly in the documentary or even maybe by those investigators, but I think the investigators did a really good job because it's easy in hindsight to look back and see the connections. It's harder to make them in real time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Especially in a transient state where people go missing all the time.
Because, you know, Florida.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I think most of my problem with this is the documentary, not like the policeman and their story. That wasn't so much. It was the documentary in the way that it was presented that was a little...
That's fair. Yeah. So they get a whole bunch of tips come in, and one person who calls in is Ted Teschner, who they had interviewed in this documentary, and he reports that he picked up Eileen as a hitchhiker and that she asked him if he thought she was a prostitute. And he said, I don't think you're a prostitute, but if you are, I'm not looking for that. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to give you a ride, which seems like a very nice thing to do. And I'm really glad he didn't die.
Yes, me too.
Then reports come in that these two women may have been staying at the Fairview Motel in Daytona under the name Cammy Marsh Green. At least one of them was named that. And so Cammy Green was finally a name they had to go on, and they found that she had pawned some items, jewelry and some items known to have been missing from Richard Mallory's car. And Florida requires a right thumbprint when you pawn items.
Smart.
Really smart.
It's smart.
I mean, okay, so it's more work to pawn something.
Yeah.
I mean, because we've gone and pawned, like, a lawnmower it worked, but we didn't have a use for it anymore. And rather than just put it on Facebook Marketplace or whatever, instead of inviting people that we don't know to our house, we just took it to a pawn shop and sold it. And I don't think we even gave them our name.
Right. I think that the whole thumbprint could feel sort of over-regulatory, as sort of oppressive in a way. But that's one of those situations where you have to sort of look at the patterns that society has established and then respond, even if you wouldn't, you know, in a vacuum, decide to make people give a thumbprint. I mean, you don't want to give a thumbprint because you're selling something. It's just that people tend to use pawn shops for this purpose.
Yeah,
and
therefore, stolen goods, right?
You have to respond in a way that...
Right. Well, and it deters people from pawning stolen goods.
Right.
If you know you're going to have to put your thumbprint on there.
Exactly, which protects the pawn shops.
Right, exactly. So they have this thumbprint that they can now try to match up. And so a tech at a fingerprint analysis center, Jenny Ahern, had run it through the automated database and gotten no matches. And so she starts the long and arduous task, which could take weeks or months, to manually try and match it up. Beyond all statistical chances, within 15 minutes, she finds it.
Yeah, it's like super, super
quick.
It's
just magical and amazing. And I don't think that there was anything nefarious about it at all. I think she just got really, really lucky.
Yeah. Oh, and she says it. She was just like, I couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
You know, how happy is she that she didn't have to spend months doing this?
Yes, like, exactly.
That was a gift for her.
It really was. And the match is Eileen Wuornos. She's been arrested with a .22 caliber 9-shot revolver in her possession. She's known to be involved in drugs, alcohol, and sex work in the area. So she fits
the profile.
The profile that they've come up with, and the fingerprint matches. So Mike Joyner is an undercover police officer, and he starts hanging out at a bar near the Fairview Motel called The Last Resort, where Eileen is known to have gone. They made it really sound like she was a regular there in the documentary.
Yeah.
Not so much.
Not so much. Even the owner was kind of like, you know, they come and go like they do.
Yeah, because it's Florida.
Because it's Florida.
So he learns that Eileen has been dating Tyria for at least a year, but she hasn't been in recently, and there's a good chance that Eileen and Tyria may have broken up, and that's why she hasn't been in. So she does finally come into the bar. I think it was a while, maybe a couple weeks, before she finally came in. And Joyner, who's wearing a wire, chats her up, trying to get evidence. And as they leave the bar together, they're both arrested. And that's to preserve Joyner's undercover status. And they put him in the back of a patrol car together so that he can
ask her, like, what's up?
Yeah.
What's going on here?
Yeah.
And he's wearing a wire, so her response gives them a lot of lead.
Yeah. I don't know. I think they think I killed somebody, which, why would she think that?
I mean, unless you, well, I don't know. I mean,
they're,
exactly.
Yeah.
You're at least involved in something.
Well, or you have an idea that they rightly or wrongly have this opinion of you.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. So then we have Prosecutor Dave Damore, and he's annoyed that there isn't more evidence. The print on Sim's car matches Eileen, but there's no body, so there's no proof of a murder. Tyria and Eileen have indeed broken up. Police find Tyria in Pennsylvania with her sister, and she agrees to help elicit a confession from Eileen in exchange for complete immunity.
Complete immunity, but there's no body. So they can't charge her for that murder. That's the one where the body's missing.
Right.
Yeah. So there's nothing really to charge her with, but she still gets immunity.
Well, accessory after the fact, right?
She absolutely.
Because she knew
that's that what she got immunity for.
Right. Yes.
The accessory charges.
Yeah. Anyway, Eileen is still very much in love with Tyria and confesses and takes full responsibility. Eileen's public defender, Michael O'Neill, advises her against giving a confession, but she insists. And she had a storage unit full of stolen items from her victim. And this is evidence that she had contact with these victims, but not evidence of really any wrongdoing. Maybe possession of stolen goods, but doesn't prove that she murdered anybody. They tell her, we need more. And she says, I threw the gun and some other stuff off the bridge. And so divers go and find it. And the gun matches in at least three of the cases. They're able to conclusively identify that as the murder weapon. And it was exactly where she said it would be. Eileen undergoes a psych evaluation by Dr. Glenn Caddy. He learns of her trauma-filled childhood, that she had a pedophile father in prison, abandoned by her mother, beaten by her grandparents who raised her. She was selling sexual acts at 8 or 9 for cigarettes and money. Tom Brokaw reports that authorities call her the first true female serial killer. And I was like, what?
What?
What about a little sidebar here? Because what about Jeanine Jones,
thank you,
the baby killer?
Yes, exactly.
What about Dorothea Puente?
Oh, she's frightening.
Murderous landlady. We've talked about both of those people on the podcast.
Yep.
Somebody we haven't talked about, maybe we will one of these days, Nanny Doss, Black Widow.
Yes.
I mean, all of those predate her. And
yeah.
All of them had been in the news.
And all of them are more serial killer than Eileen.
Well, yes.
Because serial killers don't stop. So you certainly don't throw your weapon off a bridge when you break up with somebody.
Right.
She threw it off a bridge? What?
Yeah.
She just, I don't know, stopped. Just stopped killing people. How interesting.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
None of that makes sense.
No, it doesn't make sense. But trials take place, so Eileen confesses, hoping to avoid the death penalty, and claims it was in self-defense that she was going to be raped by these men, which is a whole thing.
Whole thing. That's a whole thing.
That's a whole thing.
We'll have to kind of chat about that in a minute.
Yeah. Tyria testifies on behalf of the state of Florida. Eileen is eventually sentenced to multiple death sentences, because once she has one...
Oh, it's easy to just pile on the rest.
Yeah, just pile on the rest, because why not?
You're
going to really only kill her once.
Right, exactly. You know, so why not? But it makes a statement, and it seeks justice. I understand that.
Right. An appeal is started to prove insanity, but Eileen really wants control over her own death. Tells her defense team that she does not want them to pursue this. She's reassessed by Dr. Caddy shortly before her execution, and evidently other psychiatrists as well, and to see if she's competent to die. And again, I was like, what?
Yeah, that's a thing.
We'll get there.
And it makes sense, and we'll get there for sure.
Yeah. But Dr. Caddy believes her to be suffering from profound delusional disorder, but the court finds her fit to face execution. Eileen Wuornos dies by lethal injection October 9th of 2002, and her final words are bizarre.
Yeah.
I have them.
Oh,
let's
please read
it. I just like to say I'm sailing with the rock, and I'll be back like Independence Day with Jesus June 6th, like the movie, big mothership and all, I'll be back. I don't even know how she saw Independence Day. Wasn't she in prison?
I mean, I think so. Right? But...
maybe it came on
movies.
Maybe it came on cable.
Yeah, maybe so. Yeah. It still does.
Yes. So a year later, Monster, starring Charlize Theron, which we've mentioned, came out, and the prosecutor found it to be an inaccurate portrayal.
I thought it was very interesting.
Well, how intensely he thought it was an inaccurate portrayal.
Yeah, he hated the compassion shown to her character. there was a intense, like you said, intense disdain.
Yes.
For how Monster treated Eileen Hornos.
Yes. Her defense attorney thought the execution was inappropriate in Eileen's case, and Dr. Caddy found her to be a tragic figure based on her years and years of abuse. So that's where that documentary ends. But then you and I watched a couple other things.
We did.
Well, I think you maybe watched more than I did.
I kind of went in a rabbit hole, but we did watch one other.
Yeah, there were two other clips.
Yeah.
So they were both from a 2003 documentary called The Life and Death of a Serial Killer, where Eileen herself spoke with the documentarian.
Yeah, Nick.
Yes. And she confesses in the first clip. And says that she killed these seven men. She was convicted of six, but admits responsibility for Peter Sims, even though his body was never found. She said it was not self-defense. It was a desire to rob them. She was sorry for the pain she caused the family and that she absolutely should be executed because she would kill again if given the chance. Okay? And then there's another clip from the same documentary the day before her execution. She goes into some really wild theories.
She does.
About that the police knew she was doing this and let her do it so that she could clean up the streets. And that they had been torturing her with sonic pressure and inedible food in prison. I don't even know what sonic pressure is.
Well, there is some psychological torture things. Sonic pressure. I mean, I don't know what she was referring to when she says sonic pressure.
Uh-huh.
But there are some psyops sort of options that would fit the description of what she's saying, if not the term.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay. And then she also says she looked forward to meeting Jesus and that she's sad that she won't ever be recognized for the good that she did, which was killing these men so that they couldn't hurt other people.
Yep.
And that she saved lots of people from being raped by killing these men. So this is a real about face.
Well, it's a real about face. And she goes on a very lucid indictment of how other people have made so much money on her.
That was the most lucid part of it.
It was so lucid, and she was so clear in telling him, oh, you want to use me for all of these things. And she starts rattling off exactly how he and other people have gotten out of her story money, fame, career advancement, what it's done for other people. It's like this complete lucid thing where you use me and I let you use me. So don't come in here and then be disrespectful and challenge me on this stuff when I've given everything you want. And it was the most lucid thing. And I cried.
Aww.
I did. I cried because there was something in that voice and that lucidity that amongst all of the other sort of things that was so real and authentic that it almost made me start questioning, well, is she crazy about all this other stuff? I don't know. I found myself on a rabbit hole of conspiracy theories because I thought something is weird about this, like something strange. It was a very, very impactful clip.
Right. And it was so interesting because that part was so lucid and so really very, very accurate.
Accurate.
But all the other stuff she was saying
seemed a far-fetched and
just conspiracy theory wonderland.
Yep.
And so it's so difficult because you want to believe the parts of it that are true, pull out what is a manifestation of whatever mental illness she was dealing with and what is actually true. And when it's all mixed together like that, it can be really difficult to tell.
It can be very difficult.
All right, well, we'll come back with Is It True right after this quick break.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry, we were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right, ChumbaCasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes.
ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus
terms and conditions apply. See website for details. Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
I'm Christy.
And this is Josh.
And we are the Mountains and the Sea.
It's a podcast about Prince and his vast musical output.
We look at each and every Prince album.
And ancillary material like fashion, videos, related artists, B-sides, remixes, outtakes.
We choose a high, the mountain, a low, the sea, and a time capsule.
Yeah, those are her dumb rules, not mine.
Josh is a Prince superfan and has been since long before I met him.
That's right, and I pulled Christy over to the purple side with my wit and my charm.
The music helped. Join us every other week, anywhere you get your podcasts, and happy purple listening, friends. All right, so there's a whole lot about Eileen that they didn't cover because it was, you know, 45 minutes. They didn't have time to cover everything, but they kind of insinuated that her father was a pedophile and had abused her, and that's not true. He was in jail, but she never met him.
Right. He was a pedophile.
He was
not
a pedophile. He just didn't abuse Eileen. Her mother was, Diane Warnos, was just 14 when she married 16-year-old Leo Dale Pittman. They were only married for 2 years and divorced a couple months before Eileen was born. She never met her father at all. Her father did have a history of schizophrenia, and he actually committed suicide in prison. When Eileen was about 4, her mother, Diane, just abandoned Eileen and her brother. She left them with her parents, their maternal grandparents, who were both alcoholics. And they legally adopted Eileen and her brother at the age of 11. So accounts differ. The documentary said it was age 8 or 9. Here it says age 11, where she was selling sex for, or sexual activity for cigarettes and money. Cigarettes.
I mean, cigarettes.
Oh, like for Pete's sake. I mean, and at 11.
I mean,
all of it is troubling and sad. Her grandfather is reported to have sexually assaulted her, was known to beat her, and she was raped by a family friend and became pregnant at 14.
There are some other accounts that it was the brother.
Oh, well, yeah, she's known to have sexual activity with her brother as well.
There are some people who feel like the baby was
her brother's. Oh, okay.
So there are some different accounts on that. But nevertheless, she was extremely young. It was not a healthy, consensual relationship that resulted in a pregnancy.
No.
And at any rate, it was a absolute tragedy.
Right.
Really.
Whether it was her brother or her grandfather's friend or her grandfather or anybody. Inappropriate, wrong.
Awful.
Not a healthy, helpful relationship. Here's the thing they didn't talk about with Richard Mallory that may have been salient to Eileen's claim that he was trying to rape her, was that he had been previously tried and convicted in Maryland for intent to commit rape and had served time in a maximum security correctional facility. And the judge deemed that information inadmissible, unrelated to the case, which, okay, I get it. I get that he served his time, but it also shows a pattern of behavior.
Exactly. And it's hard to know how the judge determined but it was salient to the defense, particularly because it was self-defense that she was purporting.
Right.
Unfortunately, you can't help but think that the judge understood that she would be tried for subsequent murders and that the self-defense would not be helpful to those cases.
Right.
And that, so unfortunately, it's just not above reproach in this decision.
Sometimes
I think it's above reproach. People's
right.
criminal past doesn't necessarily need to come into the courtroom all the time because, like we said, you can be a dirtbag and not deserve to die.
Right.
But in this case, it was pretty salient, but it wouldn't have been salient for the other murders necessarily.
Right.
So, unfortunately, you have to ask the question, well, how much of that was pre-planning?
Well, and I gotta wonder, too, if he was worried that if she didn't get the death penalty in the first trial, that she wouldn't get it at all.
Right.
And that was really their goal.
Exactly. That's my thought there.
Right.
Is that they were thinking ahead about next trial. And if she was found not guilty because it was self-defense, then they kind of start from scratch. And now she gets to say, hey,
yeah,
you connected all these murders, and yet I was found not guilty for this one. So,
right.
And that would have been very, very bad for their entire umbrella case.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes. My impression is there was a part of the interview that we didn't see after that first clip that we watched of the life and death of a serial killer, the one where she said that she did it because she was into robbing people, not because she was a thrill kill, but because she was robbing them and wanted to get rid of the witnesses. My understanding is that this part occurred right after she thought the cameras were already off, and they were not. And she told him that, yes, it actually was self-defense, but she was miserable and being tortured on death row and wanted to die.
Yes, and there are multiple accounts of that.
Yeah. So Florida does have many missing persons. They're not the most.
Oh, really?
No.
I'm actually surprised.
So the National Missing and Unidentified Persons System has reported that there are over 600,000 people who go missing every single year.
Wow.
That's a lot.
That's a lot of people.
Okay, so in sheer numbers, okay. Florida's second.
Okay, who's first?
First is California.
Okay, but that makes sense.
Yes.
Because they're just so much bigger.
Right. So we'll get to that.
Okay.
So Florida had, in the time period in which all of these were, it was a year where people went missing. And I'm not sure what year that is from this article. But within the year, California had a little over 2,100 people go missing. Florida had 1,252. Yeah.
So, pretty close.
Yeah. But California is 22nd in per capita. And like you mentioned, so many more people. So 5.4 people for every 100,000 people in the population.
Wow.
So that's California. Florida's 6%, 6 for every 100,000. Would you like to guess what the top state is for missing persons per 100,000 people?
Ooh. No, I don't want to guess.
You don't want to guess?
I don't want to guess.
It's Alaska. And
really?
In this time period, they only had 309 people go missing, but that was 41.8 people for every 100,000 people in the population.
What? What?
Almost 42 people for every 100,000 people of the population.
What is going on in Alaska?
Cold. People get lost. People die because they live alone and out there and nowhere else.
And then nobody can find them.
And nobody can find them because they don't have telephones and
but
they don't see people for months on end.
But if we know they're missing, they weren't found. So they can't just die alone and then be found later. These are people who literally fell under the ice?
Maybe.
Oh my gosh.
Or they died out in the elements and were eaten.
That's a dangerous place.
Alaska is a very dangerous place, yes.
See, this is why I don't like the cold. I don't like the cold. And I don't, you know what? Wait, how much of Alaska, how much proportionally do we know is like dark for like 6 months at a time kind of thing.
I don't think it's quite that long. I think it's like about 3 months.
3 months. Okay. Mm-hmm.
But pretty much all of it.
Does that play a role, you think?
Well, I don't know.
I mean, it's perpetually like 3 a.m. Yeah. Right? Like nothing good ever happens after 2 a.m. Yeah. It's like perpetually night.
Yeah.
That's weird.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm making a lot of assumptions. I'm going to have to go down a rabbit hole with this now because I am just floored with that. I didn't expect such a landslide.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
difference.
Yeah.
Well, wow. Okay.
And the number two spot goes to Arizona, and it is an absolute landslide because it's 13 people for every 100,000.
So, and that's the desert.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Like, ugh.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, then.
So the Fairview Motel still exists.
Really?
But it has a new name.
Well, I would hope so.
It didn't for a long time. Eileen Wuornos slept in room 9. It's now renumbered as room 7. And it stayed the Fairview Inn and pretty much the same as it was when Eileen was there in 89 and 90, which is to say gross. It was not a nice place until 2011.
Wow.
Yeah. And then Mike Bach bought the motel, cleaned it up, renamed it the Scoot Inn. And did his best to distance himself and the motel's self from its past.
So unlike other locations, they didn't get a boost from being a location in a high-profile crime.
No, but he, as much as he was trying to distance it from its dubious past, he actually improved it and made it a much nicer place to stay.
That's
so
good.
Which is great, but it just means that if people want to go and stay in that particular hotel, then it's more inviting if they're going as a tourism sort of thing.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. Also in the Fairview Inn, before it became the Scoot Inn, 2007, it was the hideout for two men who were suspected of dismembering a woman and scattering her body parts around Florida. So, you know, you can't stay.
Florida. Man, I gotta tell you, Florida.
Florida. Come on,
wow.
Florida.
I gotta tell you, though, Scoot Inn, that's cute.
It's cute, right?
So my family, we have actually a little game. We come up with silly names, like the Rest Inn, like I'm resting, little things like that. And the Scoot Inn, the scooting, I don't know, like I'm scooting down the road, traveling, we come up with silly names like that. And so we're always coming up with them.
So you enjoy a punny name.
I guess we do.
The Last Resort, a bar,
is
real, still there, and very much embraces its dubious past.
Well, see, okay, they went the other route.
They sure did. They have a framed photo of Eileen on the bar. They have her photo on bottles of hot sauce, t-shirts. They have an airbrushed portrait of her on the wall with the names of the men that she murdered. They have...
See, they flirted it. I mean, they just went a little too far.
They really did, yeah. And this is where we learn this article from the New York Daily News is where we learn that Eileen really wasn't a regular customer. She came in once in a while. But it's interesting to see, again, people making money off of Eileen.
Yep. In a big, big way.
Mm-hmm. And Florida does indeed require a thumbprint. And you also have to fill out a secondhand dealer transaction form for every pawn transaction that happens. It has a description of the item that's bought in. It has to have what it's called, how big it is, the model number, the color, if it's got a gemstone or a precious metal, that has to be noted. Any identifying marks, so if it's engraved, that needs to be noted on this form, and also the thumbprint, and the records have to be kept for at least a year.
Wow, that is a lot of work to have a pawn shop when you could just have a consignment shop.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, what is...
Well, yes, but if you have people just coming in, they want to sell something. If you have a consignment shop, then you would still have to do all those things, just like a pawn shop, if you were going to outright buy something.
Really? So all consignment shops there that just buy your... And then resell.
I think so.
So unless they as owners go and pick and
right
to stock their shop, you know, otherwise right. If you go in and sell it, you still have to go through all of that.
That's my understanding.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a lot of work.
It is a lot of work. Seems like a lot of paper.
A lot of paperwork. Yeah. A lot of
paper. They kept Eileen in jail for a really long time before they charged her with anything.
They had to gather some evidence.
Well, they did, but it just seemed like... It was like 8-9 days before they charged her with anything. I was like...
It's a long time.
It is a long time. So I went looking, and according to Goldman Wetzel, a defense attorney practice, they can hold you in jail for up to 30 days without charging you with anything in Florida.
Wow.
Yeah.
Is that not, that can't be the same everywhere.
No, it's not everywhere. That's a Florida specific rule. They can, and they have another 3 days after that to actually release you. So if you haven't been charged in 30 days, they can't continue to hold you and they can't charge you with anything, but they have 3 more days after that to actually release you. So you could be in jail for no reason in Florida for 33 days.
Wow.
Which is flabbergasting to me.
I just, yeah, that's,
yeah.
I didn't like a lot of how they went about gathering evidence.
Fair.
Once she was arrested. Mm-hmm. I wasn't a big fan of it. I can't blame them. I get it. I totally do. But obviously they had enough time. And I kept thinking to myself, they're able to orchestrate quite a bit really quickly. It wasn't quickly.
No.
I mean, they had time.
Yeah.
You know? So, yeah. It's
yeah.
Weird.
So what do we know about Tyria Moore?
Oh, please, because this is a burning question for me.
Tyria was Eileen's longest relationship. They dated for about 4 years. That was their length of time they were together. Tyria claims to have disapproved of Eileen's prostitution, but not enough to not do it.
Yeah.
Not enough to not spend the money she made from it.
I don't believe anything Tyra says.
That's fair. She's quoted as saying, "Once I found out she was prostituting, I tried everything I could to have her stop doing that. For one, it's not safe. And then I did care about her, but she never gave it up." I mean, I'm all for, like, following your passions, whether or not your partner approves. But this wasn't really, like, a passion project for Eileen. It was all about the money, and it was to support Tyria.
Yes,
yeah.
It was. Because when they broke up, she threw the gun in the frickin' river.
Yes, exactly.
I'm not a fan of this chick.
Yeah.
I think this betrayal is, like, central to so much. And it speaks volumes about the relationship they had.
Right. I absolutely agree. Tyria did know about at least one of the murders because they were watching television together and Eileen came right out and said, "I have something to tell you." She said she'd shot and killed a man that day. And what her response was, "I don't want to know anymore."
Yeah. Yeah, just keep it quiet and bring home the money. That's it.
Yeah. Tyria refused to hear about where any stolen items that came into their residence were from.
Mm-hmm.
She just didn't want to know about it. Though she does say that she did feel a little bit afraid of Eileen, which I can see. She was really afraid to cross her. And that's part of the reason why they broke up was she was afraid to turn her in, she claims, before then, because if she wasn't arrested, she was worried that Eileen might murder her because she had shown a propensity towards murder. Tyria was not depicted in Monster, so they made a fully new character called Shelby Wall, because Tyria tends to be litigious and protective of her reputation. So in order to not cover her directly, they used information about activities that had happened but attributed it to someone else.
That so, made, I feel like that was a really smart decision.
That probably.
I mean, let's be fair. Tyria got out with a freaking immunity.
Yeah.
She's smart.
Yeah. Let's talk psychology.
Oh, my gosh. It's just, haven't we the whole time? It's just a whole thing.
It's a whole thing. So, I know you'll have lots to say, but I have a couple quick things.
Oh, yes.
So, investigators wondered about the difference between male and female serial killers.
Mm-hmm.
This was a question that they had. And in Science Daily has a brief of a study. And it said that researchers found male serial killers tend to hunt their victims, who are very often strangers to them, and female serial killers tend to, quote unquote, gather their victims. They target people around them who they already know, oftentimes for financial gain, usually, mm-hmm. which makes sense for Dorothea Puente.
Yeah.
That was her MO. That's the most common. Now, obviously, that's not all of them, but
yeah. Right. It is common.
And they studied this not because they want to say this is a woman's crime or this is a man's crime, just so that they can look at trends. If men are likely to commit a crime one way and women are likely to commit it another way, it just helps them build the profile.
Right. And that profile is helpful. But, you know, we make the kind of the mistake, and we all do it, is we say, oh, they fit the profile. They fit the profile. Really, the profile fits the person.
Yeah.
You do the investigation, and then the profile helps you narrow, but doesn't exclude. So it guides, right. Not excludes.
Right.
Necessarily. I mean, if you're really solid and you are an expert and you understand the profile, if somebody doesn't, you know, match your profile in some way, that might be a first indicator that this may not be the right person. But in general, you're not excluding based on the profile. You're including based on the profile.
Right. They did find that nicknames, they studied 55 male and 55 female serial killers in the United States for this particular study. And they discovered that the nicknames for women tended to denote their gender, like Jolly Jane or Tiger Woman. Eileen was the Damsel of Death.
Mm-hmm.
So very gendered. And men were more likely to suggest brutality of their crimes. So like the Kansas City Slasher,
right.
is the example that they give.
And sort of, yeah. like with victims, they tend to apparently describe the male victims by their status and their job, and female victims by their name and town.
Right.
And maybe age.
Right, maybe age.
Maybe when was the last time you heard a victim list of females that included what they did for a living, whether they were married? Unless it's mom.
Right.
Unless it's mom. It might be mom.
Well, they might list sorority sister. You know, that sort of gendered.
It's very
interesting
gendered.
That it goes for both the victims and the perpetrators.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And I was going to talk about this in the next section, but I think we're going to talk about it here because I think you'll have some stuff to say. Prostitution, sex work,
mm-hmm.
is the most dangerous profession in the United States. In the U.S., the death rate for prostitutes is 204 out of every 100,000 people in the population.
My gosh.
Yeah.
That's horrific.
It's awful. So for Alaskan fishermen, which is often noted as one of the most dangerous, I think there's a whole television show about it.
Oh, yeah. I used to watch Deadliest Catch all the time. Fart bubbles.
It's 129 out of every 100,000.
What? Whoa.
Uh-huh. And, loggers and oil riggers are very dangerous professions and also lower than that. So it's one of the most dangerous professions in the United States, and that prostitutes can expect to be physically attacked approximately every month.
That's so terrifying.
Yeah. I mean, it really, really is. And the reason I wanted to talk about that here, well, I want to say first that prostitutes are arrested far more frequently than their customers or their pimps.
That's right.
And it's just easier to catch them. And that 70% of prostitutes, female prostitutes and madams are arrested, 20% of male prostitutes and pimps, and just 10% of their clients, which really everybody's breaking the law. But it's just easier and more cost effective. But it's often seen that women aren't allowed to, sex workers, not just women, all sex workers, male or female, or somewhere in between, mm-hmm. they're seen as not being able to be possible to be raped. The because of their, because of their profession, that they've mm-hmm. basically given up the idea that it's possible for them to be raped because they sell their bodies for a living. Now, I would say there's a whole consent issue, that they're giving consent, that things are agreed upon ahead of time. And if the customer breaks that agreement, then that is where it crosses the line into rape.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought that was an interesting spot to look at here in the psychology break, that
yeah, this is a big issue.
Yeah, that, I mean, you just because somebody sells their body doesn't mean that they can't be raped.
Yes, because, and that's hard for people to wrap their mind around, but it goes back further why it's hard to wrap your mind around it. Because really, only in the last 30 plus years was it considered that a wife could be raped.
This is very true.
It was only in the last, like, 50 years that we actually thought a wife should not be beaten to the point that we made it finally criminal.
Right.
Right? And even you know, as recent, words like where it's legitimate rape comes out of the mouth of politicians as they seek to say, well, when it's legitimate rape, and then they follow it with something asinine like their body shuts down. That's a whole rabbit hole. But the point being that the reason why nobody can really understand why sex workers can be raped is because they don't actually even think that wives could be raped or right. that husbands could be raped, which unfortunately happens all the time.
Yeah.
And that is still to this day, even though it is officially acknowledged in the law, proving it and getting justice for wives who were raped, horrible. It does not happen.
Right.
And the wife is considered to be withholding sex.
Mm-hmm.
They're considered to almost be breach of contract of the marriage. They are not believed. They lose their kids. It's horrific and it's terrible. So if you think about all of that, now broaden the mind to say a sex worker who has a particular contract for certain sexual activity, and then when they choose to say no, that's not what we're doing here.
That's a breach of contract.
That's a breach of contract, and then the you know, client rapes them. And then not all sex workers are getting raped just on the job. They get raped when they haven't accepted the job,
right?
So it goes beyond that, and that goes to the she was asking for it.
Yeah. What was she wearing?
As if because they're a sex worker, that means they're open all the time, day or night, right? Sorry, that's not how that works either. So it's a whole thing, which is why people advocate for the legalization and the regulation, because then we would have we could protect a whole community of people,
right?
And that is a different argument to whether you think people should be sex workers or not.
Right.
Those two things are not actually the same conversation.
Right.
They have intersections, but they are not the same conversation.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, that's a whole thing.
Yeah.
That's a whole thing.
But I thought that was interesting to cover here, and that psychology section, only that it seems like a psychological block to say that just because people behave or do a certain thing for their job, that that makes them incapable of being victimized.
Right.
You know, that's an issue.
Right. Yeah. Well, and I mean, it goes back to Eileen.
Yeah.
Because whether or not she was raped on these incidences where she ended up killing these clients of hers, these gentlemen, she had been raped her whole life.
Right.
She had been raped her whole life. She had no other understanding of what that was. And then it goes to say, well, how much of a relationship with Tyria wasn't also an emotional rape?
Ooh, wow.
She had to go out and allow her. She wasn't a sex worker. She allowed herself to be raped so that she could get money. And it's actually a very emotional extortion.
Ooh.
I rape you, ooh, and then you get money. There's a real deep extortion there. And then she brings it home to Tyria, who then she has a romantic relationship with. And the only way that that stays that way is that she goes out and does all of this. I mean, I don't think there was a day of Eileen's life she wasn't raped.
That's horrible.
It's horrible.
Wow.
Well, so the only other thing is we've got to open this rabbit hole just a little bit.
Okay.
For her conspiracy.
About the
psychological torture.
Yeah.
Because you mentioned the sonic pressure, right? And I have to tell you, like, I was kind of like, what is going on with this chick? And what is going on? And I don't necessarily get roped into these conspiracy theories.
You're better about it than I am. And I feel like I'm pretty...
You're pretty awesome about it.
I'm pretty conspiracy theory proof, but I'm not immune completely. And I feel like I'm pretty good about that, but you're better about that than I am, so that you have followed this makes me interested to hear about it.
It's really interesting. I thought, oh my gosh, I just don't. And there's not a lot out there, by the way. And okay, there's not even wacko conspiracy sites, really. And I won't go to 4chan or 8chan. So they might be out there, but I was like, I'm not even going there. I'm looking for fake Facebook level conspiracy here, because I don't have time for all the rest of it. But I mean, I think it is interesting to note that a lot of people with the psychological disorders who have this paranoia will actually make these claims a lot. Now, okay, normally they're a little crazier. I use that word, but they're a little more out there, like that they've been chipped, that they're watching them all of the time and in places where that would be, you know, uncalled for. But well, when Eileen talks about...
Well, and she went there. She said that the police were watching her before she ever committed any murder. And, you know, she had this whole, like, right, lead up to it.
Which is true. They were, because she was arrested for prostitution.
Right.
She was actually on their radar. She does have a rap sheet. This is how they match the fingerprint. So she's not totally wrong. But if you take it as she's being watched by the government. But she never says government.
Well, she said that the police were watching her and knew she was going to do this.
Yes.
And allowed it to happen.
Right, this local police.
That really seemed, really far-fetched to
me. It's far-fetched, but usually it's grander.
Okay.
For her to really name the actual sheriff, for her to like talk about this is like a local like precinct of people, and not the government,
the
CIA, the FBI,
the Big Brother.
Yeah. There's no grandiose to her statements, which is I think what probably clued me into going, what's going on? Because it wasn't grand, and she didn't make herself more important because of it. She only used it as a point to say, you all get what you want from me.
Right.
Along with this very lucid amount of claims that is verifiable.
Huh.
Very weird, right?
Yeah.
So anyway, then she says the sonic pressure thing, right?
Right.
And we're like, okay, well, when she's talking about being watched in the interrogation room or in the cell, she's not wrong. But then the sonic pressure thing and the poisoning, that seems a little more kind of out there. But, you know, like, there are different types of psychological torture, and sensory assault is one of them.
Okay.
And this can be by changing your physical environment with sound. You've heard of people who are very sensitive to certain types of waves. And also we tell people if you're a lot of headaches, maybe you need to have a technology-free day. Like, you're getting bombarded by all kinds of blue light. You're getting bombarded by all kinds of radio frequencies. You know, and it's not really common. But there are people out there who seem to have a more sensitive reaction to that. And so they don't do well in city environments. They do better in either suburbs. Or they do better in, like, the country, because it seems like there's just a lot of pressure from that low din of the city that others are like, ah, oh, that puts me to sleep.
Yeah.
But that constant sound, it's like having tinnitus.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah, which can literally drive people to
suicide. Off the wall. It's just, so, I mean, first of all, you're in prison. You're already isolated and solitary. You have a food deprivation in that you are, the cultural foods are taken away and you're giving basic food for nutrition only, which is actually a whole other rabbit trail, by the way.
Yeah.
So you have this, and then she's worried because she got sick off of it, and now she's worried that she's being poisoned by it. And then there's this pressure, like she's got this sonic pressure, which could be an amount of sound that's just constantly being forced upon her, you know? And it's weird. Threats of violence or death. She's on death row.
Right.
There is a innate psychology going on there. There is psyops on death row, whether it's purposeful or not. Doesn't get driven insane on death row?
That makes a lot of sense.
So here's the weird conspiracy. Maybe it's not conspiracy because people are out to get them, but it does point to the fact that we are psychologically torturing individuals before we kill them. And maybe, just maybe, where she was at with her peace with death made her a little bit more insightful about the fact that she was going crazy.
Wow.
And then we go, oh, okay. Yeah. Well, then you are crazy. And now I don't listen to anything you say. Wait, what?
Yeah. What if she did have tinnitus?
What if she had tinnitus?
Maybe she just had tinnitus. And because usually the way tinnitus works is when you're in an environment with other sounds, it
goes away.
It goes away. It falls into the background. But when you're in a room that's closed in and quiet, it gets very loud and can drive you...
Really actually drive you crazy.
Literally insane.
Like, are we doing due diligence to individuals on death row?
Maybe she just had untreated tinnitus that...
It could be something simple, but I mean, you combine all of the things that we would purposely do to somebody, and you're like, hey, that's what they're living. That's weird. You know, and it does, it just brings up an interesting kind of point of the humanity of our justice system. And then do you take somebody like her who was already prone to a certain amount of personality disorder, a certain amount of torture throughout her life and all of that. And it becomes very clear that something is wrong here. But just because something's wrong doesn't mean it points to one thing. It could point to something else. It may not be a conspiracy, but it may very well be a human rights issue.
That's super fair. Okay.
Now that I've gone down a complete rabbit hole.
Okay. Real life.
Real life.
All right. So I'm going to do a little quick where are they now of some of the people who played themselves.
Ooh,
so
yes,
investigators Brian Jarvis and the backup partner to Mike Joyner, Thomas Tittle. They're both instructors for the Public Agency Training Council in Florida. In 2018, the Florida Intelligence Unit created an award for an outstanding police officer, and they named it the Mike Joyner Law Enforcement Officer of the Year Award in honor of Mike Joyner, who is now retired.
Very cool.
And he did not appear as himself in the documentary. That when they showed him, quote unquote, showed him in the documentary, he had like light behind him and you just saw his
silhouette.
And they didn't change his voice though, which I thought was interesting because it wasn't him. It was an actor portraying him.
Smart.
Mm-hmm. Prosecutor David Damore.
Yeah, where is he?
The one that was like so incensed at the compassion shown in the movie Monster towards Eileen Wuornos. Is now practicing 100% criminal defense in the state of Florida.
Well, it does make more money.
Yeah, it does make more money. But it's like interesting that he went from a prosecutor to the exact opposite. I just thought it was interesting.
That is interesting. Boy, I'd love to hear his story.
I bet it's fascinating. I didn't like him.
I didn't like him either.
And I feel bad because he's very clean cut and I'm sure very smart, but he just had zero compassion. And I get that people are like, how can you have compassion for a murderer? But she also had a terrible, horrible, awful, no good, very bad life. Mm-hmm. And I can say what she did was wrong and still say she was absolutely a victim in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Well, and I didn't feel like he could get there at all.
No, he just, he basically described her as like evil incarnate.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know, of all the people who are serial killers out there, I feel like this is not the one that's like evil incarnate.
Super fair.
I don't know.
All right. So Jenny Ahern, mm-hmm. who found her Eileen's matching fingerprint with a huge stroke of fortune. She retired in February of 2020 from working with the Seminole County Sheriff's Office. She worked in the fingerprint analysis department for a number of years and then, you know, changed jobs as people do, mm-hmm. but still within the same area. And she just retired. So good for her. I'm sorry. Yeah. She retired just in time for you know, a pandemic, but yeah. You know, Ted Teschner, the man who picked up Eileen as a
hitchhiker
and that didn't want to victimize her in any way, just wanted to help her. He and his wife have owned a Bavarian delicatessen and restaurant called Mr. Dunderback's since 1975.
Wow.
Yeah, it's been there for 45 years. As of last summer. Oh. So hopefully they're still doing
okay. Hopefully
so. But they're the oldest tenant in the Volusia Mall.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
I just thought it was interesting. And, you know, reading the account from the Daytona Beach News Journal about his restaurant, it really seems like how he seemed in the documentary. Aww. Seems like he seems in real life, like he just wants to help people and be a good person.
Oh, that's
and
great.
And I was like, oh, that's really good. I'm glad his restaurant is doing well. Is a .22 caliber handgun a good, weird to say, a good choice for murder?
Well, it does the trick, I suppose.
It does the trick.
It's concealable.
Yes. But it's really more of a self-defense weapon.
Right.
It'll stop an attack. It's enough to scare somebody trying to attack somebody else. It's if you just you shot once with it, it's depending on where you're shot, of course.
Right. But
it's
likely
less likely to be lethal. So you can stop somebody from attacking you and defend yourself without it being lethal in many cases. And it's a little easier to shoot.
Yeah.
Because it is a smaller weapon and concealable, and this site didn't really recommend it, but they said it was better than no gun at all, and if what you're looking for is something non-lethal, 22 mm-hmm. might be a good way to go, which is what explains why she had to shoot them 3, 4, 5, 6
times.
Oh,
yeah, exactly.
Because it's such a small caliber.
It's a tiny little thing. Yeah. I mean, it's just above a Red Ryder, you know? I mean, but it is small, and, you know, my mom had one, a little pearl handle, uh-huh. two shot.
Oh.
Adorable. You know, and then, and, I mean, it's so stinking cute.
Yeah.
It's
a little, anyway. It looks like a toy.
Almost.
Yeah.
Almost. And then I have another one, but that was also in the family. And, uh-huh. you know, I mean, those are, they're light. They're easy.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, this doesn't have the kickback like a 38 does. And if you want to carry a 38 and you get like a 38 special snub nose, something small like that, that's got a quite a bit of a, if you're not prepared for it,
yeah.
that'll kick back on you a little bit.
Yeah. And that could, if you're not used to shooting a weapon,
that could be a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. It might put you in more danger rather than less.
Yeah. It really could. I mean, it really could.
Yeah.
Honestly, a lot of times if you carry a gun, there's more of a danger of you being shot with it than you actually defending yourself, statistically speaking.
Right.
It doesn't go off as smooth as you think it does.
No.
You know, probably Krav Maga does you better. I don't know.
Yeah. that would be my choice. Mm-hmm. But Eileen did have a child that she gave up for adoption that they don't mention at all in the documentary.
None.
Not at all. It was a closed adoption. We know literally nothing other than the fact that it was a boy, mm-hmm. and that she gave birth to him at a home for unwed mothers.
That's so sad. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just so sad. But I'm glad that she was able to you know, have the opportunity to give the baby to a family, and mm-hmm. that seemed to be a smooth operation, and nobody's tracked him down.
Right. Yes, which I'm also glad, but I have to wonder a little bit with the history of mental illness in the family and the possibility that it's a brother-sister union that produced this child. Terrifying.
Like, what challenges might this child have?
Yeah, I mean, I hope none.
I hope none.
I hope he's fine and healthy and happy somewhere.
But I also hope that if he has those challenges, he will be in a family prepared to just simply give normal care, and right. that this person has a wonderful life despite right. the challenges.
Yes.
You know?
Here's hoping. All right. And that's all that we have. I think that's plenty.
Oh, we have so much. We're going to have a pretty decent bonus episode, I think. Because, wow. Yeah.
Yeah, wow. All right. So next time we're going to talk about Fear City on Netflix. 1970s, 1980s mafia versus the feds.
Oh my gosh. Can I tell you, I have already watched this entire series.
Yeah.
I'm going to rewatch episode one. It is so good.
Yeah. I can't wait. So you and your husband, first of all, agreed.
Oh, we agreed.
And enjoyed it.
Loved it.
So I can't wait to. Yes. I know it's got to be good because you guys agreed on Gattaca and that was great.
We did. So, and it's easier for a TV show, especially a docuseries sort of situation, for us to agree. But nevertheless.
It can push all the buttons for both of you.
A little bit.
A little easier.
A little bit.
Yeah.
Whereas a movie. Awesome.
Yeah.
But, you know, but it's so good. I'm excited to talk about this. Yeah.
Awesome. All right. Well, thanks so much for listening. We really appreciate it. We know that you make a choice when you listen to us. We don't just come on the radio. Please do rate and review because it helps us get found. Yes. And we want to be found so we can continue to make the show. Connect with us on the social media. Again, I still have a few stickers left. So if anybody wants any stickers, send us an email. Don't post your address publicly because... That's not smart.
That's not smart.
Do send us a private message with your address. And the only thing I will use it for is to write you a note and put it in the mail to you. That's all I'm going to do with it. Mm-hmm. So awesome. Well, thanks so much for listening. And until next time, be kind, be safe, and wash your hands.
See you next time.
Bum, bum, bum. Bum, bum. Da, 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 da.